center of rest in the universe, which has been brought out in this article from Science News, Volume 122, page 84, August 7th, 1982. You want me to read just one clarification further?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The astronomer in question, his name is Dr. P. Birch. They just give his first initial. Of the Manchester, University of Manchester's Nuffield Radio Astronomy Laboratory at Jodrell Bank, England. A very prestigious place with one of the biggest radio telescopes. He found that the difference is generally negative for sources lying in one half of the sky and generally positive for sources in the other half of the sky. That is to say, to go from the elongation axis to the magnetic field direction involves a right-handed rotation in one half of the sky and a left-handed rotation in the other half.
But don't we see that in the Earth? Like whirlpools move in one direction here in the northern hemisphere,
yes,
and another direction in the
absolutely
southern hemisphere.
Absolutely. It's a somewhat similar idea. Now, he says the line of division runs along the meridians defined by right ascension 9 hours and 15 minutes and 21 hours and 15 minutes. Normally, one would expect a random distribution. Here's the key point. But Birch's statistical analysis yields a probability of only 0.25% that the non-randomness arises by chance. Now, can you follow that one, figure that one out? He's saying that if it was... All right, he's saying that it's 0.25% that it could be a random distribution, and that 99.75% that it is not a random distribution, but that it is definitely an indication of a rotational effect. Now, I will finish this one statement. To test this, Birch studied a sample of very bright radio sources in which the magnetic field direction can be determined by other means. He finds that the same asymmetry, meaning the... what would you call that? That it goes left one way and right the other way. And so concludes that the effect has something to do with the universe itself, the entire universe. Okay, he has two plausible causes for such a non-random distribution of magnetic orientations. One is an overall universal magnetic field throughout the universe that is lining up the radio sources that he's been measuring. Or, as he prefers to believe or seems to feel the evidence confirms to a greater degree, it is a rotation of the universe as a whole, with the radio sources lining up with the vorticity generated by the rotation. Now, if you're good in physics and astronomy, you will understand what he's saying. That there's an axis to the whole universe, and he's measuring things that are moving in the axis left one on one half of the axis and to the right on the other half of the axis.
Well, isn't it true, Larry, that in all of the things that we have been able to really see, starting with the subatomic particles and going on up to the universe,
yeah,
that the order of one thing is mirrored in the next order, is mirrored in the next order, is mirrored in the next order, on up and down the line.
This is an ancient, even metaphysical teaching, believe it or not, from ancient philosophers, that as above, so below. As below, so above. But our modern scientists don't buy that idea.
Well, you know, they just have to kind of jump on board. Jim, does that help you?
Yeah, and in fact, I was just going to bring that point out, that why would it exist in any different gross macro scale rather than
a very... Like we had a single-minded architect, didn't we?
Yeah, it sure does.
And the design that he came up with was absolutely the very best.
And even if, you know, back to point five earlier, even if he chooses to use something like a Darwinian, in other words, just because you go to Detroit and figure out how the mechanisms for the assembly line work doesn't necessarily negate the architect that designed it.
Yeah, right.
And with regard to your point about bacteria...
Well, the assembly line was fine. How we use the assembly line sometimes gets screwed up. But...
Sure.
Exactly right.
No, I think that's an excellent argument, and you did a beautiful job in presenting. It makes all the sense in the world to me.
Well, we appreciate that response and your evaluation very much. I hope we can shake up some of the scientists out there a little bit. Okay?
Well, that's the nature of science.
Appreciate your question.
Thank you very much.
Good question, and thank you for hanging on there during the news break.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bill.
All right, let's go to Barry. He has a question about. He wants to analyze your theory just a little bit. Barry, what's on your mind?
Hi, Bill. Hi, Dr.
Can you speak
Borland
up a little? Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Fine. Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. I want to first say that you're not going to get through tonight. It's going to take about four or five more shows, I'm sure.
You may be correct on that. That's
the
plan.
I want to help slow you down. I want to take you back to one.
Okay. That's all right.
You started out talking about the poles being backwards.
What I call the great polar mix-up.
Right. I'd like to know. First of all, you said that we're mixed up because we got a tie-in with the solar system and the rest of the universe.
That was my original thesis in which I constructed this diagram. I call it the new magnetic electric model of the solar atom in my paper of 1964. But the other scientists had come up with the same conclusion from a different standpoint. I wonder if I made that clear or not. They arrived at it. But what you're saying is, based on what I had propounded in this original thesis, that because the sun is a magnet, a gigantic magnet, putting out a powerful magnetic field, which they didn't even know about in 1964. They only found this roughly in 76 or 77. And this magnetic field, they're now concluding, rides with the solar wind, and the solar wind nourishes, so to speak, or feeds into each magnetosphere of every planet that they that has a magnetosphere, of which there's at least four or five that they know of. I contend that they'll find every single one has to some slight degree. And what it's doing then is feeding magnetic energy in from the North Pole, basically, of the sun into the South Pole, it obviously has to be, of each of the planets, which has to be, therefore, with its South Pole up in comparison with the North Pole of the sun being up. Now, go ahead. I'll let you continue from that point.
Okay. I'm wondering, then, are you suggesting that the sun changes its polarity also? Because there's some excellent evidence that the Earth does it pretty regularly, and as recent as maybe 10,000 years ago. And I don't mean that the magnetic poles are wandering around.
No,
I mean
it's called a flip flop.
Yeah, a total flip flop. Now, if your theory is true, then the sun must be doing that also.
Well, we've had some axis flip flops, you know, on this planet.
I know that, and why would we have those flip flops if the sun didn't? Or do you think it does?
Well, all right, let's say this is still a moot question as to whether the sun's magnetic field flip-flops or not. Now, according to the, you know, the recent thinking and the research on the solar wind and so on in the last 20 years, they have come to the conclusion that the sun's magnetic poles reverse themselves every 22 years. That is what one of their experts was telling me a few months ago. And then when I discussed it with my Caltech friend, John Campbell, he said he couldn't buy that idea because they were trying to say well, let's go back to Maxwell's equation. If the sun keeps rotating as it does in one direction, that's its electrical field motion, right?
Yeah. Now, Maxwell is missing two or three parts of his equation, by the way, so be careful with Maxwell.
I know, and I'm coming to that maybe a little later. Okay, now, if the sun doesn't reverse its electrical field, how can it reverse its magnetic field, according to Maxwell's theory of the relationship between the two? You see, one is always supposed to be at right angles to the other.
Yes.
And you can't reverse the magnetic field of the sun without reversing the electrical field of the sun. Yet they're, you know, bold enough to suggest that kind of a crazy situation is happening. And Professor Camel couldn't buy it, and I personally can't see how they can justify it either. Now,
there are about 26 different elements of electronic theory or electromagnetic theory that are having to be totally and radically changed at the present time. And we're talking about changes that have been instituted by Dr. Bill Tiller, by Tom Bearden, and some of the others, which really let Maxwell get by with it because he didn't understand these subtle changes that have to be made. Subtle. They're just absolutely the adverse of what we're dealing with here all the time.
Yeah, I
just thought I'd throw that in.
Okay, thank you for throwing it in. Go ahead, my friend, if you have any another point.
I have only one last comment. Do you know of Edgar Rice Burroughs?
Yes.
He did Tarzan. What is
the author?
We all know of him.
Okay, he had Tarzan at the Earth's core, you know, so
yes.
It really must be hollow.
Well, you know, if...
Now, Barry, you're putting us on.
Okay, thanks for the super show. And look, I know you're not going to get all the way through, so be sure and put him back on, Bill.
Well, you know I'm going to have to, don't
you?
Yeah,
sure.
I want you to know the last time that he and John Campbell were on in December, the mail that we got on that particular appearance where we were talking about the positron was magnetic and not electromagnetic.
Yeah.
We
magnetic
got into some other
electric,
things.
To be exact.
Well, and that has been supported by some very, very, Tony Sarantinis and some of the others, Bill Tiller, Tom Bearden, they also support you in all of these sort of things.
Which is
literally changing some of the weapon systems we have in this country, by the way.
Okay,
so you know I got to bring him back, don't you?
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
All right. You see, You got a lot of fans out there, Larry. Let's go to see what Doug's on his mind. Doug?
Hello. How you doing, Bill?
All right.
Hi, Dr. Warren.
We have lost the show, Doug. We wanted to get through 26 elements.
Listen,
but I don't
I'll
think
tell you something. You guys are frying the lines tonight. What I want to know is where you're going for coffee afterwards. Because I have some things to talk to you guys about.
No,
listen, you know, my background is in the esoteric and initiatic philosophies, the ancient mysteries, and so on. But
beautiful.
A lot of people are not aware that that area is a synthesis of science, art, philosophy, and religion.
It's amazing how science is beginning to polarize toward that.
It is.
And those are the masters, and they didn't all come from the East, by the way.
That's right.
Some of them came from the West, and a lot of them were our Indian friends here in the United States.
Amen to that.
We're great physicists beyond the scope of what our modern-day physicists understand.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, you know that a lot of what they came to know was by a type of direct or intuitive perception.
True.
All of it was.
As well as whatever other methods were available. But, you know, there were the sayings such as, you cannot pluck the tiniest petal of a flower without the troubling of a distant star.
Beautiful.
And actually pointing to the implicit truth of the oneness of the universe.
Interconnectedness of all things.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They all came from the same source, didn't
they? Exactly.
Yes. And there's an etheric web that holds them all together by specific energy lines of force to the great central source.
That's right.
I'll throw that
That's
out.
Right. Now, I'll tell you this. I wasn't going to mention this, but I have had what people have called out-of-body experiences.
Oh, you? Everybody but Bill has right. had an out-of-body experience.
Right.
Well, you know, can you teach me on how to do that, Doug?
It can be done.
And
it can be taught.
No.
It can be taught. But anyhow, the point was that a couple times when it happened to me, I began to accelerate, reaching unbelievable philosophies, actually transcending this dimension, going into other dimensions.
I've heard this time and time again.
Yeah. Yeah, and what happens is as you start passing suns and stars and galaxies, you start vibrating and traveling at the rate of light, and pretty soon everything becomes that etheric web that Larry just described.
Yes,
time
and
distance are broken down.
Right, exactly. I've seen it. But anyhow, the point that I wanted to mention was some of the ancient mystics had mentioned in several places that black holes, they were aware of black holes, that they did exist. But they were also aware of what Larry's bringing out, that there's this other side to everything, and that there must be a white hole.
Exactly.
That
absolutely.
Breathes in the essence of energy and matter before there can be the black hole that collapses it.
Right. And that was even brought out by the same physicist from England who brought out the black hole theory.
Sure. And the point I think that's really important is before anything can evolve, something must involve. And in really simplistic terms, you can prove it to a scientist by telling him if he wants to drink the glass of water, you have to first fill it with water. You know, and at the same time, it's the same with the universe. Before anything can evolve, it has to have had something poured into it.
Exactly.
Even going back to the Big Bang. Now, before that super atom could expand or explode and evolve into what is going on today,
yes.
something had to involve or pour itself into that state or condition,
exactly.
and they never addressed that.
They never addressed that. I agree with you 100%. May I just present my own thesis on it?
Certainly.
Okay, I have studied Blavatsky and many of the others.
Sure.
And one quote from her book, The Isis Unveiled,
right.
addresses what she calls the great central sun
right.
concept, which, by the way, was echoed by Pythagoras in the terms he called the great central fire.
Sure.
Okay, now, this apparently represents, even to represented to the mystics of ancient times, their understanding that there was this great central source at the center of the universe. Now, there was a philosopher in the Middle Ages, a Kabbalist named Luriah, by the way, who tied this in beautifully, by the way, with the God of the Infiniverse, if you can follow me here.
Mm-hmm.
This theory then, or we'll call it hypothesis, starts this way, that in the beginning, there was only the Infiniverse.
Right.
Then out of the Infiniverse, the God of the Infiniverse, the infinite God of the Infiniverse, decided to make a creation, and in so doing knew that he had to consolidate and concentrate a certain portion of his infinite energies and substance into a central mass or a central source.
Right.
Which, by imploding those energies and concentrating them to a tremendous degree, gave it, put them under pressure, finally then, to expand outwards, so to speak. In other words, it would be saying that this is the way conceivably that the universe originally started, and that once that process was started, it would be, under his supervision, a self-perpetuating cyclic mechanism, so to speak.
Exactly.
Which continually expands until it reaches the, what Blavatsky called the ring pass knot. And that means that the universe has a maximum bound, boundary line, spherical boundary, beyond which is the infiniverse. Okay,
right.
So the universe is a child of the infiniverse.
Absolutely.
Filled with the same divine energies, only in a more concentrated form, shall we say, in its cosmic egg nucleus at the beginning of the explosion. And then that amount of energy expands outwards to a certain point and then contracts backwards, inwards, and creates this oscillating cycle. I just thought I'd throw that in.
Exactly. You two together?
Exactly.
All right, well, let me...
Bill, I can't even disagree with him on anything.
Let me do something. You know, we talked about how all things are mirrored. One order is mirrored, and another order is mirrored, another order.
Sure.
Right.
And you guys are talking about universes.
And the infinite.
And you're talking about a cosmic source that had to bring this into being.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly. All right, now let me get you back down into a microcosm, if I can, to the world that we live in.
Oh,
right.
Well, why not?
And refer you to a marvelous conversation we had with Dr. Edgar Mitchell, with whom I have enormous respect for.
Yes.
I'm just awed by a man that walked on the moon.
Yeah.
Many times.
I guess we all.
And he's been a guest on this show a couple of times.
Sure.
And he's the head of a thing called the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which you mentioned here tonight. And they have, you know, proof positive now that the human thought is in the virtual state. It's a thing. It exists.
Mm-hmm.
And it absolutely creates energy that affects your environment.
Yes.
Which makes you a very little bit of a microcosm of this very great thing that happened whenever this whole thing was thought into being before.
Right.
You and I also think things into being. Every time we think, we are creating virtual state energy. So we have to be very careful about what we create.
Sure. It's the same with speech also.
Every word is...
Right.
Lives with you forever.
We create universes. You know, you're probably familiar, maybe both of you, with Oliver Reiser's work.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time, you know, he was emphasizing the cyclical creative cosmology, which agreed pretty much with what Dr. Boren said, but at the same time said that within this greater creation and dissolution of the greater universe, there would also be pockets, galaxies, sometimes stars that have their own evolution within it, and even the universes we create in speech and thought that have their own relative timetable.
Yes.
So that all of these things are cyclical or cyclical. But one other thing I wanted to bring out that I think is very important, and I think there's a certain kind of a primitive arrogance that a lot of scientists, not so much scientists, but materialistic scientists are guilty of.
Yeah.
And it seems to be that they're almost blind in one eye, so they only see clearly what they hold in their hands.
That's because they're left-brain thinkers.
Exactly,
remember.
Exactly. But this is the point. The initiates have emphasized that consciousness and function always precede form.
Exactly.
And a lot of scientists and a lot of anthropologists have agreed that... If we had the need for a thumb, we develop a thumb.
Yes.
But what they don't agree with is that we had a need for a brain and a body, and we developed the brain and body in the exact same way as the whole universe operates.
Yeah.
Or either someone developed it for us.
Right, right.
They haven't got to that point in their thinking yet.
Exactly.
You know, talking about thinking, we have to be very, very careful. There are some scientific experiments that I know about that are going on, which were involved in the scalar wave technology of Nikola Tesla.
Right.
That the scientists have such difficulty in working with this particular experiment because their thought forms are literally materialized.
Mm-hmm.
It's mind-blowing to think about that. But it happens to be that it is going on.
Right. Yeah. You know, Bill, I think one of the problems, what your show really helps to bring out is some of the very, very badly needed information. I guess, in a sense, an awakening. You're providing a service, I think, an invaluable service, in that it's time to make more and more people aware that if a scientist who is dealing with this type of power doesn't have the conscience or the moral fabric or doesn't really have that aspect or element of the arts and philosophy and the spiritual aspects integrated,
right,
then we have some very dangerous people fooling around with those things.
Well, you know what I found out, Doug, and I appreciate your statement there very much, that the scientists that are getting into dealing with what we call, what I look upon as awesome energy.
Exactly.
Do it with fear and trepidation.
Fear and trepidation.
Simply because of what the mind is doing. Because so much of the time, this technology amplifies the mind. You're putting technology, you're amplifying mental energy or psychic energy with technology. And that can be enormously destructive unless your mind is in the right place.
That's right.
And the message that we have to get, and this is what something that Dr. Mitchell talks to us about, and I try to talk to you about it, is that we have to get our mind in the right place, because as a race, we have moved our technology to the point now that we are what we think. And we are amplifying that with our technology, and we're also amplifying that with our own evolvement. And how we think can make or break us as a race and as a planet. And we are at that stage now.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
I agree. It is a critical point, and that's one reason that...
Hopefully we'll make it.
Sure, really. I believe we will. I believe that's in our hands also.
We may have some catastrophes along the way, but I think we'll make it.
But one final point. Again, I think metaphysics and the ancient mysteries and even the current... esoteric systems and the merger between science and mysticism are so important, because they're giving birth to a type of wisdom. And so many people confuse intellect, with wisdom, and they're different.
Right.
There's a saying that wisdom is the child or the offspring that is born of the marriage of the mind and the heart.
Well, there's two things happening.
Beautiful statement.
There are a lot of people that have been receiving over the ages what we would call insightful information.
Right.
They literally were having a direct communication with forces greater than theirs. And we're laying that down as fact. Now, also, there was our pure, raw science, our from Missouri show me kind of thing.
Right.
And all at once, those two are coming together. And though they couldn't explain why the men of insight of hundreds and thousands of years ago could know these physical properties, scientifically we're now be able to see that they are right. So you're seeing them coming together.
Right.
And it's kind of a very, very exciting time to live.
It's a great time to be alive.
Great time.
Listen, a final question.
Sure.
Larry, what kind of material can we look forward to from you? What are you planning to do next, and how can we get some of your material?
Let me put it this way.
Oh, boy, are you in trouble, Doug.
You've asked the $64 question here. Here's my basic statement. I believe the best way to serve progress, which is what we're really talking about, is to be able to show, with a sense of humor, of course, that our Western civilization, our entire Western civilization, though it does have some good points, granted, is much more off the beam than any of us ever dreamed possible. It's much more, if I dare to use this word, insane, I'm going to use it anyway.
Try snake pit.
Yeah, it's a snake pit full of insanity. And do you know what insanity really means? It means being wrong and really thinking you're right and not even being willing to look at the evidence that maybe you could be wrong.
Sure.
And that's what is insane about our society. I have 15 or 20 categories of insanity here, and you go to the experts in these fields, and they don't want to recognize that there's anything wrong.
We call it having an open mind, Doug.
Right.
And that's what this show is all about.
Well, are you publishing anything right now? Larry?
You know how
moment?
Difficult it is to get people to listen to Larry Boyd.
Yeah, I mean, if I could find my friend a publisher or even a co-writer who had influence with a publisher or with a magazine or with a newspaper, anything, or a movie studio, we would put out a tremendous amount of material. I have what I call amazing new scientific discoveries,
right.
And I would like to put it out in the format of either a movie, a record, a book, a series of articles, but I've got to have some collaboration.
You see, Larry doesn't have an open mind. He doesn't understand that being on this show has greater circulation than having an article in the Los Angeles Times or in Newsweek magazine.
Is there any way that I can get in touch with you, Larry? Because that's the kind of thing. I'm a lecturer also on this subject matter, I'm involved.
Do you have a number where they can reach you, Larry?
Yes. I'm going to be out of town for a week beginning Monday, but ordinarily you could reach me if you got really something vital to share. 483-7351.
Okay.
And the best time is mornings up till noon, or if it's really crucial and no other time is available, around midnight, but no later than, say, 12:30.
Right.
11:30 to 12:30 or something like that.
Because we are involved in the networking process of bringing people together to help make some of these things a reality.
That's the only way it works these days, Doug.
So
yeah, what I believe is we've got to expose, my friend, this is the bottom line, we've got to expose how far upside down, backwards, and inside out our world really is before people will sit up and take notice and really say, my God, I didn't think things were that bad, because the newspapers aren't going to tell you it's that bad, or the television isn't, and the other experts and authorities of our...
The Open Mind Show is going to tell you.
Only the Open Mind Show is going to tell you.
That's about it.
And if you miss that number, we'll have it for you here at broadcast.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Doug, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it very much. Good to have your support. I'm Bill Jenkins with Dr. Lawrence Boron on KABC in Los Angeles. We'll be back in just a moment. think. Because we've been doing that, trying to do that here for about 4 years.
Yeah, I think basically you really have.
Let's go to, I think Bud is on the line. He wants to talk to you a little bit about gravitation, Bud.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you about confusion with complex.
About, pardon?
I listened to a dissertation here some four or five months ago by a German. He described a machine which he said they were building in Japan and Germany.
You're talking about Dr. Hans Nieper.
I don't know what his name was.
Yes.
He spoke with a very clear English with a little accent.
Okay.
And you were listening to Michael Jackson's show, I think.
Maybe it was. I don't know.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'd like to know what you know about that machine.
Gee, if you're asking me, I really have to confess ignorance on that one.
This is a tachyon field converter.
Tachyon field faster than the speed of light, right?
It pulls its energy out from a very broad thing known as the tachyon field.
Okay.
It's hard to really describe just what that really is. But nevertheless, it does work. And put the converter onto an electric motorbike. The brand name of it is Solo, a Solo motorbike. Now, you can get it with batteries in West Germany, or you can get one with a tachyon field converter. And my understanding, Bud, is that it is on the market now in West Germany. The West German government does not exactly know how it operates. I have looked at the specs from the West German government where they tested it. And the fellow says, we don't know what makes it work, but it's working.
It's not now, based on magnetic energy, pretty sure.
The way I understood it, he overcame gravitation by utilizing the magnetism of the different solar bodies.
Magnetic repulsion energy?
There is a great relationship between celestial bodies. In the case of this particular device, we're in a prime position on planet Earth because we're near two celestial bodies, being the Moon and the Sun. The Sun, of course, being the most important one.
Yeah.
They're also using this device to power heating elements in West Germany.
No kidding.
The device is also being developed here in the United States. Now, in Japan, they're using what is known as the Wankel magnetic engine, which is going to be produced in the Mazda automobile very shortly, if not already.
The magnetic repulsion type, too?
Well, it's not the same thing because the...
No fuel. In the case
of the magnetic Wankel magnetic engine, occasionally, maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks, depending on usage, you may have to plug it in a little bit. But other than that, its efficiency is extremely high. Develops about 45 horsepower.
Oh.
And that's all you need over there.
Anything related to the guy out here in Van Nuys, Ed Gray, that had a...
The Gray motor? The Gray motor is quite a different thing from what I understand.
It has no moving parts, it's not supposed to have any...
I think it's a hydrogen-based motor.
But it's supposed to work on magnetic repulsion, I believe, too.
There were a number of those now coming out of the woodwork, and I've had a chance to look at some of them, and some of the prototypes are absolutely operational and working.
Really?
Some of them work on gyros.
Hmm.
There is... a motorbike that works on a gyro uses no fuel, and you cannot push the motorbike over when the motor is running. You can't do it.
I'll be darned.
Of course, they have those on chips, too.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
But the solar motorbike is on the market in West Germany, and you don't use any fuel.
Well, let's get one over here so we can...
Government will let it out, isn't it?
Let it into the street.
Let it all ride, huh?
Yeah.
Now, I understood that he could travel. It was quite a learned dissertation. He spoke in German, but very clear English. I mean, the German accent.
Uh-huh.
But the way he described it, it's something you could travel in the universe.
Oh, really? Planet to planet, huh?
Planet to planet, utilizing the forces of the different heavenly bodies.
Well,
you have to be within proximity of celestial bodies. Now, it's very difficult for us to envision getting away from those, but you can for a while. There may be node spaces or node points out in space where you would be out of range, as it were, but I don't think that's something that, in our level of technology, we have to worry about in our lifetime.
Not quite yet.
Not before bedtime, anyway.
Yeah.
They did used to speak a lot in UFO stories of riding the magnetic currents or magnetic waves and magnetic field lines of force.
But if you want to know more about that, the gentleman's name was Dr. Hans Nieper, and he is an entrepreneur, and he is a dentist, I think, by trade. But he is very involved in this advanced science that's going on and has been helping in the funding of these particular enterprises that are going on in Europe. And you can reach Dr. Nieper very well. If you would call broadcast information here Monday morning and talk to Lita, she will give you the address of him. Lika is her name, at Broadcast Information here at KADC.
Right.
557-7365.
Right,
she will give you the address, and in fact, if you want to call him in Hanover, West Germany, I think she has a telephone number for him.
Oh.
Yeah.
But those people, you see, forgot to check with MIT to find out that they couldn't do this, and went ahead and did it.
Yeah, that's the way a lot of things happen. Some people don't believe they're didn't realize they were impossible, so they happen to go ahead and try it.
No, you check with the you know, the scientific establishment in the United States, you find out you can't do anything.
You can't.
That's right.
Right.
So you don't check with them and go ahead and do it.
That's right. Don't check with them. Okay, the next point.
Good deal. Good deal. I'll be in touch with Doctor. What's his name now?
Hans Niepper. N-I-E-P-P-E-R.
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 I may have one too many P's in there, but I don't think so.
That's close enough anyway. All right, Bill?
P-P-E-R. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much
for calling in.
let me backtrack a little bit. I was being caustic a little bit about the American scientific community. We have an excellent scientific community over here in many, many areas, and they have done some incredible things. I have had a chance to be privy to some of them.
I'll agree with that.
And I think that, on balance, they are second to no one on this planet. They have some areas where they can improve, but they, you know, are very slow to take new ideas. But fortunately, in our defense establishment especially, they have taken on some new ideas. And we're in good shape, actually.
Then they're going to make some incredible progress, probably.
Yeah, they are. Don't worry about it too much, although we like to put them down every now and then, because they are a little closed-minded about...
And a little bit arrogant.
Yeah, and arrogant, and we get a little, you know, uptight with that.
Okay.
We're 13 minutes till midnight on a Saturday night. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. With me is Dr. Lawrence Moran, and we'll be right back in just a second. A foil for everything weird that's coming on. And I think that in proper payment for all of this terrible abuse that I take from them, they could at least take me to the islands with them. Now, they say they're not going to do it. Now, I have already got it set up with Don the Beachcomber's wife to do an in-depth investigation of the kahunas when we go over there and all of that sort of thing.
Great.
There is only one problem, is that Ken and Bob are not going to take the star of their show. You know, they have the Ken and Bob Company. They got everybody. They got Daryl Winrich. They got C.G. Ware. They got Elmer Dills. They've got Barker Man. They're not going to take Barker Man either. You know, my good friend Bob Barker. Now, we know that they're getting just bags of mail from the audience, you know, to take Jenkins Man along. But they're hiding it out there someplace.
Oh, goodness sake.
Now, what I would really, really like to see...
Go ahead.
And it's simply as a matter of science and investigation, is a in-depth letter-writing, telephone, telegraph, picketing campaign.
A campaign. That's what I want to see, too.
To take Jenkins Man to Hawaii on When Ken and Bob Go. And maybe we could even talk George Green into doing an open mind show from Hawaii with, you know, the kahunas and all of those sort of things.
Really?
You know, we might as well do something worthwhile, because, you know, what Ken and Bob do is nonsense, and what we do is very, very important in this world.
Extremely.
So I would really, really appreciate a heavy bunch of letters into George Green, Wally Sherwin, Rune Aldridge. let's get, you know, all the way down. Get everybody involved, because we all know that the star of the Ken and Bob show is Jenkins Man, and so therefore, if Ken and Bob are going to Hawaii, particularly Hawaii, the Jenkins Man ought to go. And my personal engineer, Dick, has to go also. Dick Grinnett, he needs to go.
Of course.
And Barbara Essenson needs to go. And
I wouldn't mind going.
Larry Boren needs to go.
I wouldn't mind at all.
But if, and Rob wants to go over here, the my program coordinator.
Love it.
There's just no reason why Ken and Bob should go without Jenkins Man and his staff.
Right on.
So would you please send a letter to Ken and Bob and to George Green and to Wally Sherwin. You can even send it to New York. You know, to Ben Hoberman, and tell Ben that Bill ought to go. Oh, Ben will love that, but
he'll
go ahead
that.
And just... Forget the letter to Ben Hoberman. Erase that.
Erase that one.
All right, that's what the pull. But I really would like some letters. I would like for them to know that you and I are together, and, of course, you would like to see me go to Hawaii, wouldn't you? Okay, Larry, let's go to another caller and see what is on their line. I believe we have Al on the line. Hello, Al.
Hi, Bill.
Are you going to send a letter to Ken and Bob? And
I would like to go. How about taking me along?
Let's don't confuse this. Yeah, let's stick
all
with
right,
the
all right, letters.
Oh, send George a letter.
All right. And okay. Your question for this particular moment?
You'll pardon my ignorance, but you've discussed this. I'm a first-time caller, first-time listener. I didn't even know the program was on the air.
Where have you been? I've been here almost 4 years. Shame on you, what you were doing on Saturday night.
Fox in my house, right? But anyway,
go ahead.
Emmanuel Velikovsky.
Yes.
I wondered when you were talking earlier about the axis shifting. Have you? I imagine you have discussed his works on your.
Yeah, we've done a number of shows of Velikovsky.
Okay, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, there is an enormous amount of things to think about and perhaps that have been proven that Velikovsky had to offer. Some of the things I think he stretched a little bit, like Van Doniken did.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, anybody who was interested in what's going on in this universe should read Velikovsky, there's no doubt about it.
Well, at one time, though, he was considered... he was a psychiatrist, first off, right? Am I not correct?
Yeah, right.
So he was not trained in physics or...
That's why he could come up with an unorthodox view like that.
How unorthodox is it today? I mean, considering the evidence that's available.
A little problem with the comet. Other than that, he has a lot of interesting things to say.
Well, I'm wondering about the shifting of the poles.
That's an absolutely proven fact.
Well, such an event would be so cataclysmic. I mean, what I can't understand is if that happened, he's talking not about a gradual shift, as I recall.
Almost instantaneous.
Instantaneous. Okay, now he explains that the freezing of the water in Siberia and the fossils that were found there.
Or the mammoth with, tropical fruit still in his mouth.
Well, I have one question. Yeah. If something like that happened, how could anything on the Earth survive?
Nothing did, really, at the time. Or at least it was what did survive was... just the survival of the species. But you got to go, this is a long, long time ago. And as we were talking about earlier, it's almost like it was a cosmic design to get this planet lined up to the point that it could support life as we know it now. Otherwise, it couldn't have before.
All right, then life began from that point that we have now on Earth.
Well, what are you calling life? Human life or
human
just life in general?
Whatever species, living species we have on the Earth today.
Human life is a rather new thing, and it just all at once appeared in twinkling geologically. It has no rhyme or reason for it, and the things about it that propel it have nothing to do with its survival.
Well, you stated earlier about 10,000 years ago.
Probably about 40,000 years ago for the human.
Yeah, but wait a minute. Let me throw in a thought. The last flip-flop of the magnetic axis I read somewhere in one of the textbooks supposed to have occurred around 12,000 years ago. Now, that would put it right around the time of the fall of Atlantis, according to many authorities.
You're talking about a magnetic flip-flop, I think. I may be wrong, Al, but you were talking about a polar flip-flop, were you not?
Well, I'm talking
about... I mean an axis flip-flop.
I'm talking about a magnetic polar flip-flop. Now, what would you mean by an axis flip-flop?
Well, where we just... the actual axis changed of the Earth. This is what Velikovsky was talking about.
But you mean a 180-degree...
Sometimes 90, no. Sometimes 180. We have about three or four different one of those that we can pretty well document.
Okay.
Where just the axis of the planet changed. Now, we know that the polar poles change, but that doesn't affect life near as severely as the axis of the planet changing.
Possibly not.
And that could happen again at any time.
There's no reason to believe that it couldn't.
Okay, well then maybe we should all go to Hawaii and live it up.
I really think that we ought to live it up every chance we get a chance.
Well, so.
This is amazing. I didn't realize that Velikovsky, as far as I knew, of course it's been some years since I've been in college, was considered, to put it mildly, kind of like a nut.
He certainly was rejected during his day, but...
He's coming back, I guess, like Wilhelm Reich and a few others.
Right.
As Jesus said, a prophet is without honor in his own home.
In his own generation.
Okay, then Einstein was right when he said that Velikovsky would someday be recognized as probably one of the greatest scientists of the...
He did say that, and I think it's interesting that a lot of... And a lot of things about Einstein are now being disproven. Isn't that odd, you know, that it works backwards in that way?
Well, it was only towards the end of Einstein's life that he came into agreement with Velikovsky. As I understand, they knew each other. They had corresponded, I don't know how personal friends they were, but they knew each other. And it was only towards the latter stages of his life that he began to feel that Velikovsky was right, that he gave in.
No kidding.
Which is, if it's true, I don't know. See, that's why I'm asking. I don't know how much this is true. This I got out of a class in philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can only say that there's a lot of evidence that maybe supports Velikovsky if it's looked at with an open mind.
Well, see, there were some great minds that were back at that time. Einstein, of course, being one. Tesla being another.
Right.
Wilhelm Reich another one. Velikovsky has another one coming from another, you know, side of the fence.
I wonder, is there any evidence that Tesla and Einstein ever talked to each other, conferred, or...
I think they did, but I couldn't tell you for sure. They lived in two different worlds, you know. Tesla was embroiled with Edison so much, you know.
Yeah,
they were...
industrial world.
They were at the opposite ends of the fence. They were caught up in Wall Street. Both of them were... Mm-hmm. And both of them were used in a way that way. Tesla more than the other.
Yes.
Tesla, I think, was probably the greatest genius of our time.
Well, regardless of their record and how outstanding their achievements were, if all of this is true, if what Velikovsky said, even if 50% of it is true, then we are just scratching the surface. We haven't even begun to look into
the reality
of the world we're living in.
Right, and that's why we have to examine all unorthodox views of any kind that have any merit whatsoever to back them. We have to expose our minds to them and look at them and not just reject them
out of hand.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Al, thank you for your question, and I wish we had time to talk to you about Velikovsky. I'll promise you I'll do another show on him. He is a fascinating character. I'll bring Marvin Luckenbacher in here, who knows about him so well. Larry, Dr. Lawrence Morin, thank you for joining us on this Saturday night.
It's already over, Bill.
It's already over. You're going to have to come back. Promise me you will you?
Apparently I will, because I just about didn't get halfway through my list.
No, you didn't. Stay tuned for Tom Hall.
The upside
down
world.